Live from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
This is Chatterbox Video Game Radio. As always, we've got a couple of hosts manning the show. My name is Alon.
And my name's Ara.
And over there, sort of doing his business behind the glass there, that's Andrew. We are very happy to be back for another week in the studio. This is second week back after GDC, am I right?
Yeah.
I'm not losing count or anything. Last week, didn't get to talk about all the stuff that I wanted to talk about. And now you've collected a whole bunch more things that you want to talk about. So,
as usual.
Really, it means I don't have to do any work this week. You know, I don't have to plan what we're going to talk about.
Well, you know, not like we do that anyway.
Yeah. Oh. My day, you know, when we had the shows on Sundays before you were around, I think.
Yeah.
Were we on Sundays when you started?
No.
All right. When we were on Sundays, like my whole Sunday would be devoted to getting everything ready for the show.
And now we decide about an hour or less before.
Now that I have a full-time job and the show is on Monday, let me talk about my full-time job for a second. I came to the studio today and I felt great because I was smelling the orange blossoms. It was very nice out here in Phoenix this time of year. There's a short window where this city doesn't suck so much. And I remember,
and that was about a week ago.
Yeah. I remember to myself, wow, I'm feeling really good. All day has been great. A wonderful gentleman called me at work today and called me a bootlegger and a faggot. So I was very excited that I have such suitors getting a hold of me at work. So today's just been an all-around wonderful day for me.
That's a surprisingly precise insult.
You're a total sicko, you pervert.
Yeah. So...
I mean, that'd be like me calling you a lollygagger.
I don't know what that means, but teetotally. Let's get back to games. All right, so last week I sort of talked about Cliffy B a little bit. I talked more about the girls who were just wanting to jump on his junk. And unfortunately, I built a story.
Doesn't everyone?
Oh, definitely. I built the story up a little bit more than it should have been, but I have stuff to actually talk about regarding his session and why I don't think he's such a fabulous game designer.
And I'm very curious to hear this as well.
Now, other people seem to think he's great, but whatever. We'll get to that. I'm not sure what order we're going to do today in, but that's one thing I want to cover. And also Koji Kondo, who I got to see actually play live at Video Games Live while we were at in San Francisco. Koji Kondo's the guy who actually made the music for Mario and for Zelda. That's what he's most noted for. And so to see him actually play piano on stage was pretty killer. And before that, I had seen him do a session at GDC where he talked about some things that I'd really never considered. And I'm not much of a music designer. You know, I don't really think about my music in games other than when I come across really good music in a game and I can understand that this fits really well and it sets the mood. First time I experienced that, I think, was with, like, East 2 on the TurboGrafx CD.
Ah, yes. East 1 and 2.
Yeah, the music was fantastic.
That game had, like, the best music, one of the best soundtracks in any game ever made to this day, which is incredible.
Well, that and ActRaiser, the original ActRaiser for Super Nintendo, are some of the early games that made me realize that music's really important.
That one was really cool, too. I remember a while back, around the time that ActRaiser and ActRaiser 2 came out, that the composer for the ActRaiser series, his name is Yuzo Koshiro, and I remember Tommy Tallarico was going around making a joke that Yuzo Koshiro's new name is Used Up Koshiro because ActRaiser 2 soundtrack kind of sucked. But I digress.
Well, the whole ActRaiser 2 game kind of sucked because they took out everything that was good about the first one.
Yeah, that was a little disappointment there.
So anyway, it's just those were two games early on in my gaming life where I realized the importance of music in a game, or at least the potential importance of music in a game. Of course, now my favorite games are music rhythm games anyway. So I want to talk about Koji Kondo. A couple things he brought up. I don't really have a long rant on it or anything, but we'll talk about that. And then you've got a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, I've been playing Xbox Live Arcade games, so I've got a few things to say about those.
You're a lucky bastard, by the way. Some of you don't realize this, right?
I know I'm a lucky bastard.
Like, so Ara gets to work at a video game company, and there, since they develop games, they get access to, like, what is it called? The Partner Network?
There's this thing called Partner Net, and it's really interesting because, okay, Partner Net is basically what they call the network for Xbox Live Arcade that the developers have access to. And it's basically like a network where the developers test stuff on. So essentially, it's like a simulation of the real Xbox Live Arcade, but you don't pay for anything.
You just get free access to everything?
Right. So.
And do you also, Like, do you know how to contact the people who made the game so you can give feedback?
No,
it's
not quite that elaborate. But also, for some reason or another, a whole bunch of games come out on PartnerNet before they actually come out on the real Xbox Live.
Well, it makes sense. Because they're probably using it as a beta test to see.
Right.
You know,
well, there you go.
Distribution.
Exactly.
And but so I played. I wish I had access to that.
That'd yes. Be- yes. It's very cool. So I played Boom Boom Rocket, and I have some choice words to say about that. And I also have some choice words to say about Bejeweled 2 and Hexic, which, as you know, have been out for Xbox Live Arcade
pretty much
ever since the beginning.
Yeah. See, Bejeweled 2 came on my my Xbox Live Arcade unplugged disc, and Hexic came free on a bunch of people's hard drives.
Right. It comes with the system.
It didn't come
basically.
On mine.
It didn't come on your system?
I bought mine used, a premium used system, right? So it came with the hard drive. Which
what did they do? Just delete the game or what?
He must have. Like, I bought this and it had a bunch of sports games and more games. Some tool. I mean, guy when I bought the system.
What
great
a dorkwad.
But I don't know why the game was erased. Why it wasn't there.
He was like, oh, these 20 megs are just cramping my whole hard drive.
It bummed me out. But my roommate, you know, he has a system and he's got it on there. So, although he didn't even have a premium one. You had to buy the hard drive. Anyway.
That's weird.
Doesn't matter. I have access to both those games that you mentioned.
So a couple other things. I've got some listener mail to respond to, and there's this really cool article on Modojo called The Psychology of Fanboyism, which I thought was rather interesting.
I have a feeling that'll be an interesting discussion. So hopefully we'll speed through all this other stuff.
Yeah. Either that or we'll just be like, yeah, that's obvious. Okay, let's talk about something else.
Yeah. All right, so we got a few minutes before break. Little housekeeping, as always. Want to remind everybody that you can go to our website, chatterboxgameshow.com. It's also where you can join in our live chat during the show, or really any time. We got the live chat room open. I haven't even opened it up yet for the show. But that's where we communicate with people during the show, and you can do it too if you're listening live. Also, if you're listening live, 866-536-1100 is the number to call if you want to talk about any of the stuff that we talk about and get on the air, that sort of thing. Now, I'm going to lead into Cliffy B for a bit, right? Because this is what I think we'll talk about when we come back from the break. So his main point of discussion for his session was iteration is king. I don't know if that was the title of it, but
I think so, actually. Something like that.
Something to that effect.
Right.
The importance of iteration. And what he means by iteration, for those who don't know, is that basically it's kind of like trial and error. Like, you ever try to figure out a crossword or a math problem or something by successively getting closer to the real answer until you realize, oh, wait, that answer works, right? So that's what he does with game design. Comes up with your simple base concept, which for him is we're going to run around and shoot stuff. And no offense to him. I mean, that's a popular style, and that's how they made all their money with Unreal. They made some games that were not at all like that early on. And in fact, he's the guy who made Jazz Jackrabbit when he was, like, 17 in high school or something.
Which is highly lauded from
it was a
young nubile computer.
At the time, it was a good game. So anyway, they did plenty of stuff, but then Unreal comes along, and basically all they make are first-person shooters or something similar. So come up with this basic idea and then iterate. Say, hey, this works, this doesn't work, whatever.
Right.
And then there's other people who do game design. This is what, at least for people who study game design, this is sort of where they tell you to go. Right, this path, I mean.
They say don't iterate?
It's not that they say don't iterate. Basically, they say create a game design. You have a game design document, and then you stick to it, and you try to limit the changes that you apply to that as much as possible because you're going to be stuck in a hell of never-ending iteration.
Yeah, see, those things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but continue.
I know there's always a forced mix, right? You're going to have to iterate to some extent because you realize this game design idea that we've had from day one, hey, wait, this doesn't work, or some other thing that we implemented for whatever reason, whether it be some engine, physics engine, or some art style or something, right?
Might
mean that some other game design choice may have been bad or imperfect, right?
Right.
And so you want to correct. So that's obvious, right?
Well, what I found in my experience is that invariably, because you're dealing with the limits of technology and what you can implement within a certain amount of time, even though you may have a very beautiful, precise, elegant game design, more often than not, in fact, pretty much all the time in my experience, you'll come across things that will not let you implement that the way you wanted it to. And so you have to be flexible, and you have to make changes to your design in order to make the actual implementation work.
Yeah, I mean, what's in our heads doesn't always work out, definitely.
Right.
We all have these fantastic ideas, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have come across games and stuff where something they don't like is in the game, or something about the game bothers them, and they think, I would have made this differently, right?
Right. Or these people are such idiots. Why did they do this? This is the stupidest thing in the world. Guess what, guys? They probably think it's the stupidest thing in the world, too. They just couldn't do anything about it because of time or money or technical issues.
Yeah. And, I mean, it could be something simple like changing the way a menu works, but that might, you know, not integrate well with the rest of the menu or user interface system. And,
right. Well, they could have been stupid, too. So yeah. There's always that.
You know, I know that, you know, some companies outsource certain things. Like I had, a friend of a friend that I knew was working on, like, the menu system in F1 for EA or something, but he didn't work for EA.
Right.
But it was, you know, EA had, like, outsourced their user interface. It was very weird. Menu system, not really user interface, but the menu system for the game.
That's kind of weird.
I don't understand the concept of outsourcing any part of your game other than art assets.
Well, they do it to try to make it cheaper, but usually it makes it harder to control the quality of the content when you do that.
What the hell? I mean, it's actual content in a game that you interact with.
Yes.
Art assets, I can understand. You say, I need a character, right? And what you make is then going to work in my world, although that has its own set of issues.
Well, I'm guessing it probably wasn't the best UI in the world either.
Well, I mean, it was for like an F1 racing game, so how much could you really expect? not a whole lot.
Depends on the game. I don't know.
Ara's got this funny look that comes on his face when he's trying to be sarcastic and you tell it's about to come. He's like, I don't know. Anyway, there it is. We're going to go to break now, but I'll talk a little bit more in depth actually about an argument that I had with some people at GDC regarding ClickBee.
Right. I really love arguments.
That's where I think the real bulk of my complaint comes in, but came out in that discussion. So we'll be back. If you want to give us a call, it's 866-536-1100. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name is Ara.
I'm Alon.
And we've got Andrew back there, manning the sound effects and all that other crazy stuff.
Sound effects? We don't have sound effects. We get a live audience.
Every once in a while.
Live audience.
You know, that sound effect is more relevant to this show than Andrew realizes.
He doesn't realize that EA just published a game by the Bizarre people who made Geometry Wars.
Yeah.
By Bizarre, I mean Bizarre Creations. They're not definitely Bizarre people.
Right.
All right, so Boom Boom Rocket. But I got to finish up the Cliffy B thing because I started it.
It's so all you.
People are going to email and be like, why do you always talk about stuff and then not finish talking? All right, so Cliffy B saw a session. He talks about iteration. And I talk about game design, in my head anyway, not really to him. What I'm upset about is that he went on and on about presentation and graphics and all that. It didn't really go on about it in the session, but you could tell with the little remarks he would make that he really cares way too much about that, even though on one of his slides he said, gameplay is king, but presentation is really important.
Well, everybody gives that lip service, gameplay is king. Everyone says that all the time, but they don't really seem to always know what it means.
These guys are like the antithesis of that. Like, not that I think they don't care about it, but that they definitely focus all their energy on graphics, which is fine, because we want that. We want to be, you know.
Well, the thing about gameplay is it's not a well-defined term. I mean, it can be. We can define it, but it means a lot of different things to different people, and everybody has a slightly different sense of what it means. So when you say something like, oh, gameplay is king.
All right, let's talk about gameplay, though. You're going to design a new game, right?
All right.
And if it's not a game that's just a copy of something else, you probably have at least one core component, one gameplay element in that you think, all right, we're going to make a game that has this, and then we're going to build everything else around that.
Right. There's one main hook.
All right. So let me ask you, if you had to describe Gears of War, what would the hook be?
So Gears
and
of War...
I know
War,
you haven't played much of Gears of War.
Well, I've played enough.
And you remember it.
And Gears of War, to me, would be described as, I don't know...
You've got 15 seconds.
First-person shooter, but really third-person with a lot of gore and, I don't know, this really bumbling, hulky character that's in your way all the time.
Okay, so the hook is that you can take cover, which you missed completely.
All right.
Because you haven't played enough of it.
No, I knew that was a part of the game, but I don't like the way they implemented it, so that's why I didn't mention it.
Yeah, and honestly, that's something that gets better with practice.
At first, I was more
upset with than I am now, but I still have my issues.
Right.
So anyway, that's the hook. The funny part is that that's not how they decided to design the game. In fact, that didn't even come to play until Cliffy B's friend or designer buddy or whatever was like, hey, check out Kill Switch. It's got a really cool cover system. They were halfway designing the game.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, oh, that's a really cool element in Kill Switch. So let's implement that. And now the game is defined by its cover system.
Now, that's not necessarily bad all by itself.
No, I mean, games morph all the time. Like, Halo originally was an RTS on the Macintosh back in the day. And, of course, now they're actually coming out with a Halo RTS. But, I mean, things change. But, I mean, this was a first-person shooter. And my point is that they were just making another first-person shooter. And it's like, well, why even bother if you're going to make Unreal anyway? Right? And then halfway through development, someone just happened to come across this thing and said, hey, take a look at this. And
right.
then Cliffy was like, oh, yeah, that's really good. Let's go with that.
You know what's really interesting? That cover mechanic is actually one of the least accessible parts of that game.
I disagree.
You think it's one of the most accessible parts of the game? Every single person that I've seen or heard about playing it for the first time or trying it out has problems with it one way or the other.
Well, that's going to happen with anything that's, you know, not the same in other games. I mean, this is something that's sort of new. I mean, I don't want to say new and innovative, but like, it's not certainly.
It's not completely
common.
New. But the thing is that it's not very natural to somebody who just starts playing the game, because there's a lot of contextual information that the player has to memorize and understand about, okay, well, if you're on this type of surface, this kind of prompt will come up, and you have to kind of learn its own language before you can really use it effectively.
Yeah, but there's a learning curve to anything, and we can just agree to disagree. I think the learning curve on this is not bad regarding taking cover, but I don't want to get off topic.
All right, well, say what you were going to say.
For once, I want to finish a topic and let us move on to something by plan, because I know we want to talk about your fanboyism in God of War 2. So, the thing is, I'm bothered by the fact that he didn't seem to actually care about game design. And what I was noticing while I was at GDC, hearing all these Japanese developers talk, you know, they had one room where the Japanese guys would talk because they had the translating equipment.
Right.
So I was spending most of my time in that one room. Not necessarily that Gears of War is a bad game or anything, although you know my feelings on it. I don't really think it's that great when everybody else thinks it's incredible.
I'm pretty much with you on that, yeah, actually.
People are all thinking the graphics are amazing, and they forget that the game's pretty lame. But the thing is, the Japanese developers have this very different concept of gaming, and this sort of relates to what Koji Kondo talked about, which is what I wanted to mention. Like,
maybe they have a different definition of gameplay.
Well, in the case of Koji, not so much, but yeah. I mean, it's not a different concept of gameplay, but a different approach in how you produce it. And Japanese developers in general think of the entire concept. First of all, they think about it ahead of time, because I think they're just more studious about how they want to develop something. And they think about all the different aspects and how it can affect the world and how it can affect their players and how each bit affects the rest of the game. And, I mean, you have to do that part in gameplay. But like Koji Kondo was talking about, when he creates music for a yeah. game, he doesn't just create one track and let it represent itself. All the tracks work together as, you know, a system of music that create a mood for an entire game. And so
that's very smart.
You know, he doesn't finish a song and then show it to his boss, his team lead, or whatever the person would be he would show it to. Like,
yes, he hides the whole thing years until it's done. That's awesome.
He keeps it to himself. He makes the next one, and he makes the next one. Then he's like, well, no, this one, you know, I'm going to change this little bit over here in order to make it work better with this song, because they all work together. And I really just get the impression that American developers, and certainly this isn't, you know, broken down just American and Japanese, but they seem to fly a little bit more by the seat of their pants, care less about gameplay design, and care more about things that are really less important to the flow of a game. And in general, that's why I have like this, you know, I told you I'm not very starstruck, but I still want autographs of game developers.
Right.
But like, I value my Japanese autographs more, maybe because they're hard to find because they're in Japan, but I really feel like they have done like a life's work, you know.
Yeah. What it sounds like is, I don't know if this is just a cultural thing or what, but the Japanese, I've been told that one of the main differences also between Japanese and American developers is that the Japanese developers seem to seek perfection a lot more, I don't know what the word is, strongly than in general other developers.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And it's so hard to place. Like, I wasn't sitting in the studios for 3 years while they're making Gears of War, however long it took them, right?
Right.
All I have is one 50-minute session or I can judge a guy who's standing on a podium under lights. So it's kind of tough, but you can get a feeling for, you know, what are their goals, how are they approaching this, and what priorities do they have? And it just seems very, very different when you look at, first of all, a seasoned game designer. And Cliffy's been doing it for, what, like 10 or 12 years? And that's a really long time. But at the same time, he's, you know, it's relatively short compared to those of other people in the industry, where you just get the impression that they put a lot more care into it.
Yeah, and, although I have to say, this has nothing to do with Cliffy B or anyone else in particular, but especially in the video game industry, I've never seen an industry where experience in general has really been such a poor predictor at someone's ability to make a great game or to do excellent work in any aspect of video game production. I've seen noobs do incredible work. I've seen people who have been in this industry for 15 years and do S.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for innovation and fresh eyeballs and all that. But do you have any idea, like, why that is?
Why? I think that good video game design is not... I mean, there's certainly a lot of things that you earn from being experienced, but I think it's because experience all by itself doesn't necessarily net you anything, especially in an industry like this where experience, you know, if you know what you're doing, if you've been here for a long time, that's very valuable to employers. So it's also very easy, I think, depending on where you are, to just kind of like stay there and stagnate creatively. So yes, you can have 5, 6, 10 years of experience, but it depends on what you do with it. And a lot of people, they don't spend that time in a valuable way.
I think this particular topic we could talk about for a long time, getting away from Cliffy B. But anyway, we're going to be back after break. Enjoy some commercials, and then we will talk about Fanboy.
I'm going to enjoy some coffee.
Hey, it's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's number one. Woohoo!
We're back again, the second half of the show. This is Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name's Alon.
And my name's Ara.
And we're going to finish the show now. Well, sort of the second half, like I said.
It's all downhill from here.
I have this thing where I start talking about something.
And then the music keeps playing.
Well, no, that's fine. I'm fine. But like, I sort of lose my focus.
Well,
us gamers depend.
You know, just like video game development, sometimes things don't go as planned.
Yeah.
So you gotta be flexible.
Touché. So before I can continue my thought, though, I have to remind everyone of our wonderful sponsor, UAT, University of Advancing Technology, uat.edu. They teach you how to make games, how to design. I have a lot of my game design theory, or at least my best practice knowledge, is out of my education at UAT. I enjoyed some of it. Good times.
So we were talking about Cliffy B's.
Yeah, game design. All right, so I just we'll go away from Cliffy B, but what was most interesting to me was the impromptu argument I had with the people that I met at one of the parties.
Okay,
this was
that Sweet Night thing that
yeah.
I was there too.
Yeah, we were there, and I mean you were talking to somebody else at the time, but then I started getting into this argument. Yeah, and then you and your buddy were sitting next to me, but just getting this argument about Cliffy B and how they thought he was great, and I was like, no, iteration is king. It's like, okay, yeah, iterate if you want. But you should also kind of have a core game design. And it's just funny to me that Gears of War, the most prevalent part of that game, what's most important about it,
right.
the hook,
right.
wasn't even intended until like halfway through. And I'm making up the halfway. I don't know when during development it happened, but it certainly was not at all the focus of the game, and it just happened, you know.
Well, to me...
happened to happen.
Say something like iteration is king is so obvious. It is really the most important thing.
I don't know. I think a good plan ahead of time is kind of key.
Well, that's important too, but I do think that because, and I don't want to go into circles here, but video game development in general, it's way too unpredictable. So I do think that edges out the importance of iteration in your process.
Yeah, but that's like for those who are as old as myself, when you're trying to tune... anything.
Right. Well, the thing that iteration doesn't mean is let's keep adding features. That's not iteration. That's what some people like to call featureitis, which is really, really bad.
Yeah.
So as far as...
feature creep.
Right. Or feature creep, which is, you know, the, I guess the edgier way to say it. Anyway, you know, there's... All right, I lost it.
All right, so...
Talk about something else.
Fine. Let's just move on beyond beyond the Cliffy B. The one point I was going to make is that iteration is kind of like fine-tuning, but you forgot to do all the major tuning, at least if you're claiming it's more important.
Right. The iteration is the fine-tuning. If you do major tuning over and over, you don't finish a product, so...
Yeah.
Or you end up with something really messed up.
I just think that the other stuff before you get to the fine-tuning is more important. So... Let's move on.
Okay,
I don't want to beat that dead horse.
I've got a really funny story about God of War 2. I know we've been meaning to talk about this.
Yeah, we've been getting listener mail. People want us to talk about it. Unfortunately, I haven't even gotten a chance to play it, so it's pretty much all you at this point.
I've only played the demo, and I have a very, very telling tale of myself and two other game developers, three designers, in fact, who were playing the God of War 2 demo at work today.
Okay.
And now, basically, we get to one point in the demo where we're not all playing at the same time, obviously. One person's playing and the other two are watching. We get to this point where you're fighting the Colossus. The Colossus, as you might imagine, is this big statue thing. Very Roman-looking statue. He wants to kill you and do bad things to you.
That sounds about right, given that it's a Colossus.
And you're walking around and you're trying to figure out how to beat this thing. You get to a point where you can't. The screen won't scroll anymore, right? So you're stuck. And there's Colossus in front of you. We're like, okay, obviously you have to fight this Colossus now, right? There's this...
If you read the Penny Arcade comic today, then you would know what you're supposed to do.
We did not read that.
Okay.
Anyway, so we're trying to figure out what to do. We hit the thing when his arm comes out. Oh, this metal clanging sound. Obviously, you're not supposed to do that. We try to... use the little contraption, what is it called?
His blade. I don't know what they're called.
It's kind of like a catapult thing, but not really, but it basically functions the same way. No, if you do that, he just crushes the stone, and if you can put yourself in the catapult, and no, he'll just...
You've got a catapult in God of War 2?
It's not a catapult. There's some other weird word. It's not that either, but it's essentially, for sake of argument, let's say it's a catapult.
Okay.
Anyway, we were on this thing for like 15 minutes. Three game designers trying to figure out what to do.
You ever play Shadow of Colossus?
We have played Shadow of Colossus. We couldn't figure out what to do. And it was the most... Once we finally figured out, it was the most retarded thing in the world, which is that, yes, even though... Despite the fact that when you hit the guy's arm, it makes this metal clanging sound, which in almost every video game known to man means, this is ineffective, don't do this.
Yeah.
And of which we got no other feedback out of... That's what you were supposed to do. And if you had kept on hitting it over and over, eventually he'd react and go, need to get hurt. And
wow.
So that to me is God of War in a nutshell, the first one. And, you know, from what I've seen in the second one, it's the same old story. I'm not impressed by God of War.
I'm sure it's a very similar game the second time around, but the first one was awesome. And screw you. It was great. And I wish that the Blockbuster disc that I had would get past the certain level instead of stopping to be read so that I could continue the whole game.
I'll concede that it is technically in a very, very, very impressive game. But design-wise, in what I've seen from the demo and from what I've played of God of War 1, they make these just really weird, nonsensical design decisions that end up confusing the player.
I haven't played the second one. First one, any game you have little issues with, but for the most part, it was pretty fantastic. Figuring out what to do sometimes was a pain in the butt, but a lot of games do that.
Yeah, but that's BS. If a game is good design, in my opinion, is where the player never gets to the point where, oh, I have to figure out what to do.
Well, not a puzzle.
A puzzle, the best kinds of puzzles are the ones where the player has all the information or... has all the means to seek the information that they have to find, and it's a matter of skill in finishing the puzzle, not some kind of weird lateral thinking and like interpreting, you know, something that looks like this is actually something that, or oh, look behind in the back of the box where a secret code or something retarded like that.
One thing I'll agree with is that I don't think you should ever not realize that you're in the middle of a puzzle. You shouldn't just think that you're in some sort of you know, straightforward path, doing what you're supposed to be doing, and meanwhile, you're actually supposed to be figuring something out. That's
yes.
a little bit weird to me.
Well,
I don't know
it's all about,
what God of War 2 is like.
To me, it's all about communication, right? So if... And it's all about the player knowing what tools they have at their disposal. If the player has to try to figure out what their tools are or what things they're allowed to do and not allowed to do, I don't think that's good design.
Well, this leads into perhaps a more interesting discussion where you should ask the question, should your beliefs of past video game experience or what you've grown to understand about video games based on past games affect your current gaming? And the way I relate to this is that in The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, I was playing through relatively early in the game. There was a time where you have to, you know, a lot of the time in Zelda, you have to figure out how to unlock the door or just how to make it open.
Right.
Like you have to either kill all the guys on the screen or you have to light some things on fire or whatever.
Right.
And if you don't do that, the door won't open. So I'm stuck in here and I can't figure it out. And there's not that much to do. There's like two doors and it's an empty room with a torch. And I don't know what the hell to do.
Right.
And for some reason, and it seems very obvious to me now what I had to do, but all I had to do, like I had to grab a stick. You have a stick of wood in Ocarina of Time that you can grab, and I had to make the stick touch the flame of one torch and then light some unlit torches in the room. Once they were all lit, then the door would open. But, I mean, I sat there for like half an hour not knowing what to do and just giving up because I had built in my brain certain limitations.
Right, well, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. This is bad. I mean, I presume that this experience you had while trying to figure this out is not good.
Yeah, because there's no indication that I'm supposed to be lighting torches.
Exactly. And that's where the game had... Not only that, you didn't know that you could actually walk up to the torch with the stick in your hand and have it automatically lit. Is that right?
Well, that's correct. But I think that was the little education area, teaching me that I could do that.
Right. See, the
but
problem...
forcing me into learning it.
Right. But the problem they made there is that they were a little too, I don't know, ham-fisted with that approach, I guess. They could have...
Catching the fish in the newest Twilight Princess Zelda, that's their new thing that pissed me off. I always get stuck in Zelda in some way because I don't have enough education.
Yeah. See, ideally, they need to present these things to the player in a very gentle way. So.
But I didn't get stuck when I was a kid. That's the thing. I'm an adult who's played enough games that it gets ingrained in my head. And now maybe in God of War 2, if you hadn't played so many video games or you were willing to free your mind from the presumption that a clang sound means something bad.
Right.
Because, I mean, a clang, a sword on stone, like, what are you going to get? Probably going to get a clang. So it might make sense.
No, that's true. And in fact, you know what? I have to admit, it wasn't us that figured it out. Someone else came in the room and just started, like, pressing the button and, okay, let's attack the hand. And he just... didn't pay attention to what was happening, and then after five or six hits, then he goes, and he hit the Colossus. And so it's funny because him not paying attention to the feedback, he figured out what to do. But us, because we were so observant and careful and trying to figure out things, that actually worked against us.
Yeah, no, and that has happened to me before too. And that's why, like, after the Ocarina of Time experience, I try to intentionally sort of loosen up my mental boundaries. What I expect in a game and what I'm willing to do. Ever since that day, because I was like, no, you can't do that. I think I even thought about it and thought, no, you can't do that. That's just, you know, that's too much for a game or they're not going to put that in. And now I'm willing to, like, try anything because they might have figured out a way to build that sort of thing into a video game.
Yeah. Hey, if you guys want to call in, it's 866-536-1100.
We got a little bit more time left. We'll come back after the break and talk about... something else.
Hey, no, we'll have some coffee. We'll talk.
Fanboys.
Welcome back, guys. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio. I'm Aura.
I'm Alon.
Now, I think we have some housekeeping issues.
Well, always. I didn't mention earlier that you can hear our show rerun or re-aired or freshly renewed on Wednesday evenings on All Games Radio. That's at allgames.com. And
who's our boy down there?
Lawrence.
Our boy Lawrence, yeah.
And Scott Rubin and Bobby Blackwell.
All those guys.
Yeah. They actually do a show every day, Monday through Friday, before all the other shows air. So like Wednesday, you'll hear their show. You'll hear me come on talking about what we're about to talk about. For instance, in 2 days, I'll be talking about what we're discussing right now.
Well, that's some kind of crazy time warp thing going on.
Exactly. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the psychology of fanboyism. Now, let me tell you, by the way, if you want to be a fanboy and not feel out of place, you could go to UAT.
Yes.
University of Advancing Technology. where they're not all fanboys. Some of them are perky little chicks trying to get in Cliffy B's pants, but the other ones are like fanboys.
About two of them.
Or can be, at least. All right, so what is this article that that you picked up?
So I'm going to read you some words from this article. This was on a site called Modojo. And this article explains how people tend to become fans of what they buy or what they use or what they play.
It's standard psychology.
And what they're postulating is it's not because they really like what they buy or they learn to like what they buy, but it's primarily a means of justifying their investment, which I think is very, very interesting. So here's a little story. Back in 1968, there were two researchers, and they studied people who bet on horse races. And so they looked at this group of bettors, and they said, okay, well, some of you have put down a $2 bet, and some of you are about to put down a $2 bet on a horse, right? And so they interviewed these bettors, and they said, okay, on a 7-point scale, now rate your confidence on whether you think your horse is going to win or not. So 7 means you're very, very confident, 100% chance. 1 means you're not confident. And what they found out is that on the average, if you hadn't bet your money yet, people's selection on the scale would be around 3.48. But if they had already bet before they had found out whether they had won or not, their confidence was actually 4.81.
Okay, so in other words, right in the middle or above center.
Right. The implication here is that something happens in people's minds that makes them more confident about their choices after they make them.
Uh-huh.
So I'll let it sink in a little bit.
No, I can respect that.
So what this guy says in this article is that, you know, people always want a lot of options, but the choices are a double-edged sword. You may have a lot of alternatives, but everyone knows that even after making a hard decision, the agony is far from over. You know, going to one college or another, you know, I went to University of Maryland. You know, what if I went to Carnegie Mellon instead? Or
I've
what
never
if
thought
I,
that. I always thought, you know what, I'm going to go to one school out of, you know, the two that I was choosing from or whatever, and whatever, my life will come out of that school and I won't know what could have happened. So
that's a great attitude to have. But a lot of people don't do this. You know, they think about, well, what if I would have picked this or the other thing? And what this is called, or what they call it, is this thing called post-decisional dissonance, which is a really, really fancy word for saying that after you've made a decision, there's some conflict in your head about whether it was the right decision or not. So what happens is that your brain deals with this by changing the way that you feel about it in order to be consistent with the choice you made. So
that's fascinating.
So it's this kind of, it's what a lot of psychologists call confabulation. Which
so your
is,
brain will actually tell you that you felt better about that decision?
Well, obviously there isn't a little guy in there being like, oh, you made the right choice. But you tend
I've
to feel...
I've got a mouse with a wheel inside of my
right,
head, actually.
But you tend to feel better about the decision that you make because since you made it and you have responsibility for it, you know, you don't want to tell yourself that you made a bad decision. You want to tell yourself you made a good decision. So this is kind of like this way of, you know, this is apparently this phenomenon that can explain fanboyism, which is why this guy wrote this article. So I thought that was really interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that you can see in a lot of areas of life, apparently, horse racing. But also, I mean, this might spread to just your home team, right?
Right. It goes across pretty much everything we do. I mean, not just video games, which is what's really fascinating about it.
Yeah. I could see where you're coming from here. I'd like to think that people would have the means to get all of the systems, and then they don't have to be a fanboy of anything in particular.
Right.
At least if we're talking about video game systems, at least.
Right. This is. I've always been shocked about how enraged people get at video game system discussions. I mean, to me...
You're kidding me.
To me... No, I'm always surprised because to me, it's hardware. It's not the game. It doesn't do anything by itself. How can you say... I mean, I guess if you're a programmer, you can be like, oh, yes, you know, the X68K architecture is a lot cooler because you have all these registers.
Super Nintendo, way more colors on screen than Genesis.
Right. Okay, fine. You can debate that. But as far as the games, I mean, come on. It has absolutely nothing. You rate each game by itself, regardless of what system it's on. Who cares? you know, who cares what the logo is? This is, it's basically like arguing that, oh, you know, the logo of this is better, so I like
it. And we've all had those arguments before, and that's what's funny. And I think perhaps even my argument with the Cliffy B guys, his admirers, were possibly sort of going along this grain here, where they, I'm sure, bought the game and were very happy with the game and love it. And so they must think that, or maybe they just invest a lot of time in it. And they want to convince themselves that they've played this game for so long, it must be good. And they don't want to think to themselves, okay, I've been playing this game over and over and over, and maybe it's actually not any good.
Well, this also goes along with mob mentality. If a game is so popular, then of course it must be good. Oh, look, this game sold millions. Of course it must be good if everybody else thinks it's good.
What game is like that to you most recently?
What do you mean?
Can you think about a game that you sort of decided to play just because... Because, like, everything on the Wii falls into that category for me.
And then you end up liking it because you've been playing it?
No. I really played it because of mob mentality.
Right.
It's like, oh, Raven Rabbits. Everyone thinks that's a good game. Oh, I'll definitely play that. No, I don't really think it's good.
Well, I'm kind of a weirdo, and I kind of tend to dissent against popular opinion anyway, so I don't know if that...
That's why you love Ridge Racer so much now.
Well, I hate to admit it, but yeah, you know what? Like, I have the opposite problem of this, right? Instead of liking things that a lot of people really like, I tend to kind of step back from them a little more. But that's just, you know, my little personality.
I'm thinking we might have a lot of listeners that feel that way, who shove ourselves in our own little nerdy niche.
Well, there you go.
I like stuff to be a little bit different.
Yes.
That's fine.
Viva la différence!
But my game buying decisions, I certainly try to go with the majority, because usually, I mean, if a bunch of people are buying the game, it's probably good. And even Gears of War, I've had fun with. A lot of people bought it. And it's not all horrible.
Well, I've become so careful about buying games because I've been burned so many times on games I think would be good.
Yeah, I've seen your box of games that you're trying to sell on eBay. Like, just get rid of.
Yeah, that's pretty much an ongoing process, really.
Yeah, got to clean out the house. All right, so we have cleaned out another week of show. Another
Once
week
again.
Of wonderful Chatterbox programming. So we're going to be back next week, as always. Do we have anything we want to
send us
email for next week? Yeah, we had somebody wanted us to talk more about Gears of War 2, and maybe by next week I will have actually played it, and we can talk about the game
God
maybe
of War.
Not sucking.
God of War 2.
Is that God of War?
Yeah.
Is it Gears of War 2?
Yeah.
Whatever. God of War 2. I'm sure it actually is a fantastic game, but I reserve judgment until I actually play
they're
it.
They're both steaming. I mean, they're both awesome.
We'll be back next week, everybody. Thanks
Bye, guys.
For listening.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your bass belong to us.